What's the room again?
1240, down at the end.
Ooh, what's that?
Sammy, don't touch that. That's someone's old food.
Here we are. Do you have the key?
You have both of ours.
Oh, right. Not working.
Rub it.
Come on.
Try flipping it over.
Seriously.
Why can't we go inside?
I'm tired.
Give me yours.
You have mine.
All right.
What? Please, if you
Dad,
could just...
Dad, why aren't you opening the door?
Can everyone just shut the...
Don't go there. Go on a real vacation. Go RVing. Learn more at GoRVing.com.
Brand new streaming service, Disney Plus.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently a victim of its own success, but officials hope that things run more smoothly today than yesterday. They launched around 3 a.m., and over the next 4 hours had thousands and thousands of reports of people unable to access the brand new video streaming service. Disney says that the demand exceeded its expectations.
Streaming will never replace live television. You know why?
Why is that?
Because the guys like Tan Trung, who is sitting across from me right now. That's why.
That's very generous of you.
Yeah,
well, you could stream that too.
It's up to you to save the industry, Tom. No pressure, but it's up to you to save the industry, all right?
I think I'm going to need help on that, Tommy. Yeah.
I just don't understand how Disney can say they didn't, as much as they've pushed this, as much as they've promoted it, as much as they knew that people were hungering and hankering for this, that the demand exceeded expectations.
Well, you know, sometimes you put a line in front of a place, even if you got to pay them, to make it look as though it's very popular, just to... So I don't know if that was pre-planned or not. Let me get to Tan Trung here, who... first off, welcome, Tan. I've seen you on TV a whole bunch, and it's nice to meet you.
Thank you, Tommy. I'm glad to be here. I listen to you all the time.
Well, thank you.
The feeling is mutual.
When it comes to the... And I want to get to your history and so forth. I know you can spend the hour with us, because I think it's a fascinating story, but I had no idea they had canals... Or I guess you would call them drainage canals, right?
They are.
Underneath the city like they do in Paris almost. I had no idea that was the way. I know we had different pipes leading to different pipes, but I didn't know there was anything you get and walk around.
I didn't know either, and I think that's the fun part of doing what we do is you get to discover things. But I think after the multiple events that we saw, especially with the heavy rains, the Mother's Day flood, and then you had the July 10th flood, then you go back to... The August 5th flood in 2017, they had to figure something out, and there was something happening that there were different places in the city that were flooding that normally didn't see that much flooding. Mm-hmm. We're used to flooding in to some level, but there were just areas of the city that were getting water that didn't take on water. But it was after that event where they pulled the car out of the canal that they said something's happening underneath. And, as I saw that, they laid out that they were inspecting the canals, and I just said, we should hop onto that. And I didn't know, just like you, that we didn't, there's a network of canals. There's 180 miles, so roughly half of that is above ground, the canals that we get to see, and we're going to get into that in part two tonight of the special series. But there's another 90 miles that are underneath the city surface.
That big that you can walk around in?
28 feet wide.
Wow.
9 feet tall. I mean, you can fit a Mack truck through there if it's 9 feet tall.
Okay.
But yeah, it's a massive network. And I was just amazed at the brickwork, the masonry work that the old timers had laid out.
Did it remind you of something in Europe?
I've never been in the tunnels in Europe, but man.
But from what you've seen,
Yeah, absolutely. I think those were, the times where there was attention paid to work, especially in how they built things. I think today we just slap down some concrete and just call it done. But it was amazing to see that the amount of work and detail laid out in the subsurface canals. And that particular canal was the St. Louis Canal, so you can take it right to Basin Street. So pretty nasty. It moves most of the water and the drainage water from the French Quarter out to the lake. So it's funneling down, then it gets turned into an area that turns into a corner that then gets pushed off to pump station number 2 under Broad Street. And
didn't you get pretty close to that?
Yeah, we got close to it, and unfortunately I was ill prepared because I didn't know how much water we'd see down there. But I think if we had hip waders, I just went with the old shrimp boots, the Cajun Converse version.
Who got the water? And I would advise y'all to go to WWLTV.com. You can see the story if you missed it last night. But who got water in the boot? Was it the cameraman?
That was Steve Wolfram. That was our camera guy. I mean, he's an excellent photographer. he was champing at the bit to get down there, because you know he's one of those types that, you know, when you do a story that's kind of unique and you're going to get into places that a few people have seen, he's up for it. So he had a special low light camera, but he too was ill prepared just like me, and he had just the regular shrimp boots, and it was slippery. You know, it was V shaped, so the edges come up towards the brick walls, but then it comes down because that's the way it's designed to kind of keep the water moving. All the water that comes in from those lateral pipes that they have coming from the street will push the water to the middle, and then it rises. And so as it rises, it keeps the water moving towards the suction bay that gets to the pump station. But it was slippery as hell on those edges.
I try to avoid any kind of, you know, bathroom talk or anything like that, because I don't think anybody,
especially
really
in the
wants,
morning,
right, wants to hear that. Exactly. However, are you talking about the canals where water overflows from the street, which again would not be potable water, but it'd be better than what people are flushing down the commode? So you were walking through water that ran down from the street?
Yes. Yeah, okay. It's a drainage canal. A sewage canal is a sewage pipe would be a different deal. But you've been to the French Quarter, so
a lot
of that water is moving from the French Quarter down to, you know, St. Louis Street and then to pump station number two. So that used to be from and we spoke with an engineer with levees.org. I didn't know this, and it was this fascinating history, and, you know, for all the history buffs out there, many of these drainage canals used to be, and especially the open canals, which, again, we're going to get into in part two tonight, used to be navigational canals. So there was traffic on there. There was commerce going up and down from the French Quarter down towards the lake. And they just kind of use these same routes for these drainage canals. But, you know, to get back to your original question, that there could be some pretty nasty water if you know, especially when you've been in the French Quarter.
What freaked me out, Jerry, were the roaches. I mean, they had, 1,000 roaches?
Oh, there are too many to count. But again, you know, David Capel, the engineer with the Sewage and Water Board, who was helping us with the inspections, he said, look, that's a good sign. That means you got oxygen down there. But I like the positive spin on that. But we weren't alone down there.
I would say this, Todd, anytime you're in an environment where they tell you, oh, well, it's a good thing that you got roaches because that means there's air, not a good vacation spot, generally speaking.
No, I wouldn't recommend it as an Airbnb.
You got guts, man. I'm telling you. We're going to take a break, pick it up here when we come back. And Tom's one of those guys that we watch, and he's got a very interesting story behind him, and we're going to delve into that, too. When we come back, I want to ask you about this canal. Was that one that was normally filled or not, or is it wide open? And we'll talk more when we come back. If you have any questions or comments, you can text them in 87870, and I'll pass them along to Tom, and he can give us an answer. Tommy Tucker back in a flash, WWL. 922. I'm happy to have Ton Trungen here. We met for the first time. Ton doesn't remember this. He was dressed as a member of KISS, I think it was, on Mardi Gras, and he was trying to get a coconut. So he was a little busy, and I was busy too, because we were elbowing each other out of the way to get the coconut. So you go down in this canal. Is that the right thing?
It is.
Underground canal.
Subsurface canal, yeah.
For those of you that have not seen this, again, go to WWLTV.com and take a look at it. Because we talk about these different size pipes, right? But this is what these pipes enter into underground to get the water to the pumping station.
Absolutely. And, you know, we heard time and time again when we had those heavy rain and the big floods in the past couple of years, clean out your catch basins. So this is where the water goes when you open up your catch basins. All the stuff that's happening and coming down, that's where it is. And that ends up in this canal. And, you know, if you don't clean out those catch basins, it doesn't get into that canal and doesn't get pushed out to the pumps.
Was the canal that you were walking through at one point clogged up, and is this part of the cleaning thing that they did?
It's a great question. I mean, when we went down there, it wasn't as clogged as I imagined it to be, because I think, again, when it's out of sight, it's out of mind. We didn't know what we were going to walk into, but remarkably, it was clean. But as the engineer was explaining to me, the way that it's designed, it has a lot of self-cleaning, that the shape of it is always going to keep pushing the debris and the turbulent water, or the turbid water, whatever you like to call it. It's always going to push it upwards and then funnel it down. And we're going to get more in depth in part two tonight. The canals you need to worry about, and really, it's the open canals that you see that you need to worry about.
Did the Sewage and Water Board guy give you any indication as to the canal that you were in, if it would be one of those May torrential rainstorms or what have you, how high the water would have been?
Absolutely. So the, you know, we were talking in the last segment that the canal is 28 feet wide from wall to wall, mm-hmm. 9 feet high from the top of the canal to the bottom of the canal. So take the July 10th flood that a lot of us went through, and that flooded parts of mid-city, downtown, so on and so forth. So that particular canal, the engineer was telling me, if we were to stand in that canal on that day, and obviously that'd be an idiotic thing to do, that would have been completely filled with water.
Really?
Top to bottom. And it would just be gushing towards the pump station. And that particular canal that emptied into pump station number 2 and then finally into the Lafitte Canal along the Lafitte Greenway, that canal that you could actually see near pump station number 2 near Broad Street was overtopping.
And that's the one that they pulled the car out of, right?
Absolutely. So think about how much water is moving. That's a damn high wall that you're looking at when it's, you know, for that open canal. That thing was overtopping during that flood.
So in the canal that you were in, that was the water was like, what, a foot or something like that?
Yeah, maybe a foot, maybe,
so
in parts.
The water would have backed up in that and then, or not, it would have, it just kept flowing and then overflowed the banks of the Lafitte Canal.
Yeah, in that particular canal, you know, my assumption, and by no means am I claiming I'm an engineer, but your problem isn't getting the water to the pump station and getting it pumped out. It's actually, it's the backup that once you get to the pump station, there's so much water coming in. The pumps can only pump a certain amount of water per hour. And when you're getting that amount of water, again, that's just one canal that we're talking about. So think about it, 28 feet wide, 9 feet tall. That entire canal is filled with water pushing towards the pump station. And then you get multiple lines going into other pump stations as well. That's a huge amount of water that, again, you know, not giving anybody a pass or sewage and water board, there's not many pump systems that could keep up with that amount of water.
Did you see a map of all of these underground canals?
We just saw a map of that particular canal. And, you know, the biggest area of concern, and tonight we're going to talk more about that, it's just, I don't think we have a firm grasp on how many canals have been inspected at what time.
And when you say we, you mean you, the media, we, the citizens,
we the media,
or
we the
citizens. Sewage and Water
Board?
Yeah,
we're all in this together at
you
this point.
You think the Sewage and Water Board knows?
You're going to have to watch part 2
I
tonight,
guess I
Tommy.
Will. All right. Is it a two-part series or three-part?
Yeah, two-part series. The second part airs tonight. And this you know, the pictures were great last night, and that's part of television. I'll be fully honest about that. And it gave us an insight and a kind of peek into an area that we haven't seen. But I think that the crux of the big important issue is going to be tonight and why we need to be concerned.
You know, one thing I wanted to bring up too, the videographer. You guys can't do anything without these videographers, and I think they deserve a shout out. I really do.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, Steve Wolfram, I mean he's a trooper. And you know, we have a great staff of photographers. I love them all. And certain ones have different attributes that will lend to different stories. You know, we have investigative guys that do great for investigative pieces, feature guys, but Steve's the one guy that knows the technical aspects of it. He'll get down and dirty with you. I mean, that's not a glamorous job when going down to a manhole.
Yeah, he's got to bring a camera with him, too.
Yeah.
Did you have to convince him to do that, or did he volunteer?
Not at all. I broached him with the idea. I mean, you know, we had to convince the Sewage and Water Board first of what we were doing, and I know that the Sewage and Water Board has taken a lot of hits in the last couple of years, and many people argue rightly so. You know, my approach to this story was, look, if you're going to inspect this and you want to inform people about what's going on, let us go with you. But once we did that, it took a little time to convince them, and they gave us a lot of access, all credit due to them. And once I had the green light from the station and then the Sewage and Water Board, it didn't take a lot of convincing for Steve to get
you did
on.
Have to sign some papers too, did you not?
We signed our life away. We knew what we were getting into for sure. But you know, luckily, and my wife still forgives me, we, you know, we have life insurance, and I had to take a couple showers before getting into bed.
I would
that
imagine
night.
So yeah. Do you have kids or not, huh?
No, not yet.
You want them?
Sure.
Okay. You can have one of mine. No, I'm kidding, because she's still on her payroll. We're going to have to take a break for CBS here at 9:31 about the impeachment inquiry. And I'm going to get into your personal life you know, I mean, your history and so forth after the break. But quickly, I know you're a big basketball fan.
Huge.
So you look at the Pelicans. The only teams below them in that conference, I guess, is the Golden State Warriors, who were in the championship game last year, right? The series. And Steph Curry's hurt, is that right?
He's got a broken hand.
So are you making a comparison? Can you make a comparison? Because I don't know much about basketball. Between Zion being out with the Pelicans and Steph being out with the Warriors, and that both of these teams have a lot of potential that maybe is going to show up later in the year when they get their stars back?
I think the potential threshold for the Pelicans is sky's the limit to me. It was a complete rebuild after Anthony Davis left. Zion is a once-in-a-generation player, and I think we haven't even seen his potential at all. The Golden State Warriors are rebuilding after multiple kind of collapses due to injury, team breakdown. The team chemistry, and you know, obviously I'm not a coach, the team chemistry isn't there where it used to be. After Kevin Durant left and all the drama with Draymond Green, I don't think that team is going to be what it used to be.
He's an interesting guy. We're going to go into his career and background when we come back. He came over as a refugee, correct?
Absolutely.
And and then it's, to me, the typical American success story where his parents worked hard, he worked hard, and he worked for the network for a while. We'll go into that. And now he's in the sewer. That's not a good way to put
it. I'm not going
to
stay there, though.
I've been waiting to use that line since we decided to do this. No, you're not going to stay there at all. Real quick, because we got a hard break coming up here. Is Surge and Waterboard more accessible now than they used to be now that we got a new director?
I think they're more accessible. They're more transparent. And I think they didn't have a choice.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Tan Trung, more when we come back. We're going to talk about the impeachment inquiry right now with an update from CBS News. And I guarantee you're going to be entertained when we come back with Tan's story. Here's the update, CBS. .939, 21 before 10, WWL. I'm Tommy Tucker. Tan Trung, nice enough to spend some time with us. Your story is a very interesting one in that you came over this country as a refugee, did you not?
In 78, my family was in South Vietnam during the war, and, you know, typical coming to immigrant story during that time, at least. I mean, we got on a boat and, you know, had to navigate some pretty rough waters in the physical and literal sense, too. And we landed in Thailand and stayed in refugee camp for 9 months, which, you know, at that point in the story, when I tell most folks that, you know, we made it to a refugee camp. They're like, thank God you made it to a refugee camp. And I often tell people, have you ever been
You've
to a refugee camp?
You've never been in one, yeah.
Yeah.
How old were you at this time, Tom?
I was two, so I don't remember Jack from that time and from what my brother and sisters tell me. And I'm lucky. You know, my oldest brother was 9 at that point, and everybody else, you know, successfully at that point, you know, kind of navigated that time. But that's tough, I mean, to think about. My parents were 31 and 32, respectively, at that time. They had 5 children, and, you know, my grandparents were there, too. It was a rough time to pull them out of a war zone and then go into a completely different place. And don't get me wrong. I mean, we're blessed to be in the U.S., but culturally, you don't speak the language. You spent basically half your life in one place, and now you're going to in a completely different world.
It's almost like you've gone to another planet, completely different.
Well, and we landed in upstate New York, of all places.
Completely different planet.
Yeah. We went from the jungle to the frozen tundra.
What was it like growing up there?
Look, I love upstate New York. I love New Orleans first, for sure, but in terms of being in a hometown, in a small town in the U.S., you know, our first apartment was a 2-bedroom apartment. We had 14 people in the family. My extended family was
one
with
bathroom.
Us. One bathroom,
God bless
but we were in a golf course. So Jim and Ida Shear were part of our sponsors of this Catholic church in upstate New York, and he was the proprietor of this golf course. And old Jim used to love being in the clubhouse, so he'd get a little tipsy right around noon, and then he'd take us on golf cart rides, you know, a little tipsy.
Oh,
and
nice.
It was fun. I mean, we'd open the front door, and we were in the first hole, beautifully manicured, and for a kid, that was great.
So you're a teenager, you're spending your time. I know your mom or dad opened a restaurant at some point, right? They working for GE?
Yeah, they're working for General Electric in Binghamton, New York. And, you know, times were good. I mean, that was right into the Cold War. I'm not saying that the Cold War was good, but the defense budgets were pretty stiff during that time, and you know, stuff was cranking, so they worked on flight controls for a lot of the jets that were kind of were being manufactured at that time. My dad was a self-taught engineer. My mom didn't have much education, but they were on the assembly line, and my dad worked his way up in GE, but then administrations changed and the budgets got cut, especially for the defense budget. My parents got laid off because formally they didn't have any education. So circumstances forced them to, we had, trust me, a string of unsuccessful businesses on this particular property across from our house on Willow Street in Johnson City. And then we just, you know, my dad kind of gambled and my mom did as well. And we put everything into a restaurant and there you go. You know, you had an immigrant family that opened up a restaurant. A lot of folks do that.
No, but I think of resilience, because first of all, you go to this different planet, a different country, a different culture, different language, vastly different climate. Everything is going along pretty well with GE, and then all of a sudden, guess what? Rug pulled out from underneath you again and start all over. And that's why I think your family's story is a quintessential American one, because at a lot of opportunities, you know, you could have given up or how many kids involved at this point?
Yeah, so we had six kids, you know, that were here. My oldest brother died in Vietnam as an infant. That was my parents' first child. He died of measles. Mm. You know, there were no vaccinations in Vietnam at that time. You know, I think that's a lesson for a lot of folks when you talk about this debate about vaccinations. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we had a family of eight, and, you know, we were strapped for cash and not a whole lot of options, but my parents made it work.
Can you imagine having eight children or six or however many to provide for? See, that frightens me when you say that, because I'm a nut having a 23-year-old still on a payroll. But my God in heaven, that had to just terrify your parents. And again, it goes to resilience where, well, we nothing else we can do. We got to find something that's successful, and they did.
Yeah, you know, and I think that it's, you know, our story, I think you can relate to it even if you're not an immigrant, if you're not a refugee, but particularly for New Orleanians here, you know, when you have trauma in your life, and I think many of us have trauma going through Katrina, you have now a baseline for traumatic events in your life. So when you talk about resilience, you know, that's what the exodus from Vietnam did for my parents. I think when you face getting in a boat, escaping pirates, not getting killed, not getting captured, you realize that if you get laid off, you're going to be all right. Mm-hmm. You're going to be okay.
You've seen the worst of it.
Yeah. And I think especially for people in New Orleans, whatever happens from here on out after Katrina, we're going to be okay. You faced probably the worst event, hopefully the worst event in your life already, and something like that doesn't happen again. But we have a baseline for dramatic and traumatic events.
Katrina played a part in your career too, right? Because at some point you were with NBC, filing reports for the network on the NBC nightly news and so forth.
Yeah, it wasn't overnight. It wasn't overnight after the storm for sure. I mean that, but I think for a young guy like me at that time, I was much younger then. It made me realize how to report on a major event like that, and it matured me. I was a 26-year-old guy at that point, and I'll be the first to admit I wasn't a very mature guy. Mm-hmm. But seeing all the heartbreaking events that happened and realizing, you know, where my place was in telling that story, it definitely honed my skills as a reporter. And that's not me beating my chest, say, look at me. Because, you know, I went to a couple other stations after that, but eventually I did. NBC News did pick me up, and you know that brought me to a different kind of level in terms of understanding how journalism works. And you know, to today, I think I'm a much better reporter. I hope I am. You know, that's subjective for sure.
So, at what point did New Orleans become your home, or did you decide that this is where you're going to live?
I'll tell you what. You know, it was interesting. I was with the network in 2011. And, you know, after covering the BP oil spill, I was going back and forth. I spent a lot of time here during the BP oil spill because the network realized I used to work here and I could pronounce Port Fourchon, not Port Fourchon. Mm-hmm. And you know, those are big things. I remember that Brian Williams said Port Fourchon on air, and I sent the EP a text and said, it's Port Fourchon.
You didn't correct him on air, though, did
no,
you?
No,
yeah,
no.
Yeah, I wouldn't have done that.
You don't want the whip cracked on you like that, but I kept on coming back here, and even at the car rental place, you know, on the street, I'm known as Tron, around here.
Really?
My name mispronounced a lot, but it's a sign of affection, I think, mm-hmm. for a lot of New Orleanians here. I used to see guys at the car rental place at Armstrong International. They said, "Hey, when you coming back, boy?" I said, "As soon as I can, I'm back today."
Mm-hmm.
And I realized then that I missed that. I missed that part of being in a community. It was great being with the network, you know, and I think that my father seeing me before he passed on national television was a good moment, but that was more of a selfish intention. You know, it was great to give him that, but I didn't feel part of a community when I was just kind of traveling, living out of my suitcase and doing, you know, spots for the national news. Here, people know me, even if they pronounce my name incorrectly. They know I'm the news guy. You know, I'm newsman on the street. And I have a role, and that's nice, you know, and considering all the identity issues I had when I was a young kid feeling out of place, you know, this place has welcomed me more than any place in the U.S., and I thank New Orleans for that. It's a beautiful place.
Are you married to a New Orleans girl or not?
Oh, man, I am married to a South Georgia girl, but she was born and raised in Atlanta, and I'll have to tell people this.
Uh-oh.
She's a Braves fan, not a Falcons fan. She's okay. A Braves fan.
Because there could have been trouble over the weekend.
Oh, no, look, over this weekend, the girl was out tailgating. She had black and gold on, foot to head.
How'd you two meet?
So she owns a coffee and tea shop, Dr. Bombay's Underwater Tea Party.
Here?
No, it was in Atlanta. I was based in Atlanta when I was working for NBC News, working out of the Southeast Bureau.
Mm.
And I'm cheap. I'm Vietnamese, man. I'm an immigrant, so I don't pay for anything. So I went to her coffee shop because I would hijack her Wi-Fi because this is when I was still downloading music. So they had free Wi-Fi, so all I'd do was, you know.
But you were paying for the music you downloaded.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. I'm going to plead the fifth on that. But
so at
yes.
What point, so you're going and using her free Wi-Fi, right, at the place?
Yeah, I'm using her free Wi-Fi, and I see this beautiful girl. You know, she's the proprietor. I didn't know that. I thought she was the woman working at the counter. But actually, three days before I was supposed to come back to New Orleans because I was, you know, I didn't get my contract renewed with NBC News. That's a whole different story there. But I was set to come back to New Orleans. You know, my former boss here at WWL-TV, you know, had a great opportunity for me to come back to New Orleans, and I always wanted to come back to New Orleans. So my crappy Honda Accord was packed up. I had everything in the car. And
I hear you talk about that car often. Is it really?
That's my old car. Oh yes.
Okay.
I will show you.
Been flooded twice. Is that what you said?
Flooded twice. Yeah. It's still kicking though. Still kicking.
So at what point did you know that? And what's your wife's first name?
So her given name was Anna Christie. But her grandfather used to call her Cottrell because it was the nickname he gave her. It was one of his favorite hardware stores was Cottrell. Who knows? That's history for you.
You
boy.
Don't know, but that's what I love is because there is always, as you know better than I, there's always a story behind somebody and there are so many details that are so interesting, like your wife being named after a hardware store. And I don't mean that negatively. I'm just saying
that's the truth.
It's the way it is. So at what point do you decide she's going to be your wife and how did you propose?
So we, right before I was about to leave for New Orleans, you know, we started dating for a little bit and we went back and forth. She was still in Atlanta and I was back here trying to reestablish my career. And, you know, there was right before it was Lundi Gras and, you know, we got dressed up. It was one of those nights that we actually could go to the ball. They were nice enough to invite us. So I made a grilled cheese sandwich. I had bought a ring and right before we were about to leave, I served her that grilled cheese sandwich, and I got down on one knee and gave it to her, and we got married in a weird ceremony in Vietnam, and it was great. It was great. I'm not the perfect husband. I'll be the first to admit that, but she puts up with my stuff.
Why grilled cheese?
She doesn't eat meat. Mm-hmm. She loves grilled cheese, and that's what she was going to eat that night. That's what she wanted.
I'm just concerned somebody would have bitten into it and broken a tooth.
Oh, no, it wasn't in the sandwich, though.
I didn't know. Tom, thank you for coming in, man. I think the
Tom,
world
man,
to
I appreciate
you.
It.
I love watching you on TV, and I wish you nothing but the best. And there's a, man, I'm going to tell you what, again, I think it's just the typical American success story, what you and your family have managed to, I guess, both overcome and achieve.
Tommy, proud to be here. great being here with you. Love listening to you, and great to be here with you.
All right, so part two tonight.
Part two, 10 o'clock.
10 o'clock, and Ton goes back to the sewer. But... Do you not? Are you back in the sewer?
I'm above ground for most of this, but yeah. Well, we revisit the sewer tonight for sure.
But you'll learn something about the sewage and water board.
Oh yeah, okay. Yeah. I think everybody else will tonight too.
All right, thank you, sir. We'll be back. Newell Norman's coming up. Tell you what he has on WWL.
What's the room again?
1240 down at the end.
Ooh, what's that?
Sammy, don't touch that. That's someone's old food.
Here we are. Do you have the key?
You have both of ours.
Oh, right. Not working.
Rub it.
Come on.
Try flipping it over.
Seriously.
Why can't we go inside?
I'm tired.
Give me yours.
You have mine.
All right. What?
Please, if you
Dad,
could just...
Dad, why aren't you opening the door?
Can everyone just shut the...
Don't go there. Go on a real vacation. Go RVing. Learn more at GoRVing.com.